Welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The brothers Anderson are... This is Eric.
It is better to be truthful and good than to not.
This is Brother Jay.
You ask me if I have a God complex? Let me tell you something. I am God.
This is Drew.
Why? If it ain't a clown. You know, I never found clowns that funny myself.
And they're sometimes joined by guests like...
This is Travis.
I had to stop her from screaming.
And Diane.
If you men only knew.
So sit back, close your eyes, and let us take you away. Unless you're driving, in which case keep your eyes open and watch the road. And, you know, anyway. So we ready to start this thing?
Yes.
Okay, well, welcome. This is Eric.
This is Drew.
And tonight we're going to talk about the 2010 movie The American, directed by Anton Corbijn, who is probably best known as a Dutch photographer and a music video director.
I knew nothing about him and still don't know anything about him other than he directed this movie.
Let me give you a little bit of background. He is a photographer first. He did a lot of, he followed music acts around. So he did a lot of concert photography. He had lots of, I think for a while, every issue of NME magazine was a cover shot by him. He did a lot of covers for Vogue. He's done music videos and portraits of like U2 and Bowie and Depeche Mode and Tom Waits and Nirvana and Leonard Cohen. He won some kind of award for the music video for Heart-Shaped Box for Nirvana.
Oh, wow.
But he took like the Joshua Tree cover. That's his photo. And several bands like U2 and Depeche Mode both considered him like a member of the band because he traveled with them. So he was their guy.
It's like a modern day Cameron Crowe.
Kinda, yeah. Super shy, son of a minister. By the way, why did we watch this movie?
What conclusion did you reach? Why do you think we watched this movie?
Oh, I can, it's a good movie. I mean, it actually, of the things that Not in a Creepy Way like in movies, it has every one of them. It's well written, it's well acted, and it's beautiful.
Yeah, we have been doing a lot of more popular movies lately. So I just felt like getting back to, you know, something like Collateral, where it was out there, you know, it was a widely known movie, but maybe not that popular. One that I really enjoyed, but I didn't know anybody else who has seen it. So I thought it would be fun to discuss. And I consider this to be a very engineering-y movie.
I'll have you explain that in just a second. This movie had a problem. The best way to sum up this movie's problem is that Anton Corbijn got trailer fucked. The movie opened on Labor Day weekend, and the trailer they put out, which he had no control over. He did not make the trailer. In fact, I guess most directors don't make the trailers. It's all studio done. And that trailer showed an action movie, like some sort of like Taken kind of thing.
Oh no!
Yeah.
Oh no!
Yeah. So the quote from him. And I think this was from The Guardian. The quote is that a lot of critics were angry. The trailer looked like it was one thing, a fast-paced popcorn Hollywood thriller, when it was something entirely different. So when they got into screenings and found out that it was a European take on Westerns, they were furious. They were expecting Spider-Man 13, and he gave them Sergio Leone.
I don't remember why I originally watched. I believe it was from a Roger Ebert recommendation.
Well, he gave it 4 stars. He loved this movie. He considered this to be a Japanese samurai movie.
Yeah, no, I can totally see that. I appreciated the economy of dialogue in this movie.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. There's not a lot of dialogue. There's not a lot of action. But the way that it's fed to you is, I think, perfect. I mean, it's a European-paced movie, but there's enough action and enough going on, enough tension, that you're not bored.
Yeah, and timely for you. I assume you noticed the In Bruges connection.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. I didn't recognize her at the time, but when I went to find out who all these people were, I was delighted to find the very pregnant Marie is a not very pregnant Matilda.
And did you also discover that the other female lead is the daughter of one of the characters in my all-time favorite movie?
Oh, I did not know that.
Yes, Carla is the daughter of the actress who played Apollonia in Godfather Part 2.
Oh, interesting. Well, her name, I love the actress's name.
But probably not. The last name is Placido, right?
Yeah. Her first name is Violante.
Hmm.
Violante Placido, violent and peaceful. I think that's the translation. I could be wrong.
I want to see her in more things.
Oh, me too. She actually, a lot of these actors have done a ton of stuff. Like, it seems like if you wanted to hire somebody who, probably spoke Italian, but also could play any number of priests, professors, or European detectives, you got Paolo Bonicelli, who plays Father Benedetto, because he looks like a European detective, a priest, or a professor.
Yeah, and he's good.
Oh, he's very good. Yeah. Shall we just dive into the plot?
I think we should.
Yeah. So, of course, as always, we're going to spoil the movie. But this is a very simple plot. And it's not entirely, super twisty, although there are fun surprises in it. But it's a fairly predictable sort of plot. We start out with Jack. Maybe his name's Jack. It's never really clear. George Clooney. And he and his lover Ingrid, and her name I will not try to say, the actress, they're relaxing in a cabin in Sweden. George Clooney in this movie is very brooding. In fact, halfway through the movie, I'm like, oh, he does this haunted, stoic, broody silence so well. He would be an excellent Batman.
As it turns out.
Yeah, fucking Schumacher.
This movie really hinges on his ability to use his charisma to carry the viewer through the experience, because he doesn't talk a lot. He's not particularly pleasant, but he is always compelling.
Oh, yeah. And there's something going on during this whole movie. You don't always know what it is, but there's something going on, and that's he translates that look. A lot of the critics that didn't like this movie thought that A, it was slow, and B, he was sort of flat. But I would contend that the flatness was a choice.
I didn't think he was flat at all. I think those critics are going to find themselves on the wrong side of history.
Absolutely. So anyway, so we meet Jack and Ingrid. But not for long, because they get bundled up and go out for a walk in the snow. And Ingrid notices, or actually Jack notices a single pair of footprints in the snow. And Ingrid sort of chatting about how hunters or something, but hunters are going pairs. Well, Jack is instantly alarmed, and they kind of take cover just before the shooting starts. And so Jack pulls out his gun, and Ingrid is shocked that he even has a gun. And he takes out the sniper and then instantly yells at her to go to the cabin and call the police. And she, after a little bit of freaking out, she turns and runs toward the cabin, and he shoots her in the back of the head, because that's what a kind of guy Jack is.
Yeah, he definitely follows Neil McCauley's philosophy from Heat. Never entangle yourself in a relationship that you can't leave in 5 seconds flat if you feel the heat coming around the corner.
Okay, here's a dumb question. I'll probably edit, strictly for time reasons, of course. Is that why the movie's called Heat?
one of them.
Okay, all right. See, I'm not your smart older brother. I'm just saying. It's hilarious. I never thought of that.
We can dive into that more when we cover Heat on this podcast.
Yeah. Well, that'll have to be our three-part, let's see, what should we aim for? Perhaps Pearl Harbor Day episode?
There you go.
I think we can get 3 3-hour podcasts out of it.
I could.
Yeah. So it's a little tangent. The latest Entertainment Weekly has a little article about the filming of The Island of Dr. Moreau with Marlon Brando and Val Kilmer and Fairuza Balk, but she's never even mentioned. And it's
oh, that must have really chapped your eye.
Oh, it did. But it was written by the director who was fired not long. I mean, I guess halfway through maybe the production. But he and Val Kilmer were not friends. He has nothing good to say about Val Kilmer. He says he can't even watch the movie Heat because he's so angry at Val Kilmer.
What did Val Kilmer do to him?
Well, apparently Val Kilmer was all happy to do the project until he got his check, and then he instantly started complaining about everything. And eventually, this director says he got him fired. So, again, I know nothing about this. I'm sure I didn't even know until a couple weeks ago that he was a Christian Scientist, Val Kilmer.
I didn't know that until right now.
Yeah, well, there's a really good podcast called Oh No, Ross and Carrie, and they go out and they do everything from ear candling to they both became Mormons for the podcast. And then they kind of, after the experience, they kind of rate on a level of like creepiness and pseudoscience and pocket draining, like wallet draining value, all these experiences are. So it's very good. I'd recommend it. Oh No, Ross and Carrie on the Maximum Fun Network.
Did they ever become Scientologists?
I don't think they have touched Scientology yet. I think they are a little bit scared of litigiousness, since Scientologists are known for going after people, like on purpose as a major tenet. Yeah. Some people try to convert one way, and some people actually go after and intend to destroy the detractors. Like to bury them and salt the earth, that it's that kind of thing. Yeah. You can take on the Mormons, because you know the Mormons may have weirdo views or whatever, but generally, you know, they're pretty nice. Apparently, if you're on the good and the bad side of the Scientologists, you got to watch your back forever.
Yeah, you and Jason never did do The Gift, right?
Oh, we're going to. Are you kidding? That's one of our mom's favorite movies. Or it's possible that it's just a movie she really liked for like 1 year, but now it won't translate. I recall bestowing a lot of ALF memorabilia on our grandmother, probably based on one comment she made saying, "Hey, I watched the show ALF. It was pretty funny."
That's how it goes.
Yeah. So, yeah, be careful. Yeah, guard your passions close, lest they be used against you.
Oh, I do.
Your likes and your dislikes. It's very important. Keep it all bottled in. That's what I suggest for people.
I found out recently at a training I had at my workplace that high level of self-awareness. I have a low, what was the term? Emotional intelligence, because I tend to poker face the people I interact with. Means I don't give them the opportunity to get clues from me.
Huh. So that they consider that to be selfish on your part?
Yeah, essentially. That's what I took out of it before I said a curse word in my head and then checked out.
Did you have to like take a test or something? Is that how you found this out?
I did. Yeah, it was one of those personality type tests.
Have you done
the engineer side of my personality, when I didn't necessarily agree with the results, I took it again just to try and test what the tolerances were for answering the questions differently. So I had a fundamental disagreement with how the questions were worded, because all these different questions about, it was an emotional intelligence test, so it was a bunch of different questions about how you perceive emotions, how you process emotions, how you use the knowledge that you assume about other people's emotions to interact with them. But you're supposed to answer them on the scale that goes from never to always, you know, one of those. And I believe that if you are truly self-aware, you are never going to answer in either extreme, because I think to be that secure in your answer that you would actually pick an always or never, you would have to have a high level of hubris or straight up arrogance to have that degree of certainty. But if you don't pick those are what you need. You need to pick the extremes in order to rate highly on their emotional intelligence scale.
Oh, that's funny. So, like, you can pick a bunch of, like, if it was a scale from 1 to 10, if you picked a bunch of 7s, you still would not score high.
Yes.
You are an engineer.
But if you picked a bunch of 10s, and you're like, oh, I have high emotional intelligence, but you're a monster.
Oh, of course. All extremes are monsters.
Yes.
Yeah. Actually, fear anyone who is certain of anything.
Yeah. So I went into the training with that attitude. So I was that asshole in the group.
Well, okay. Knowing very few engineers relative to you, because I'm sure everybody's on a spectrum in every group. Although, you know, engineers have the reputation of being probably rather far down on the emotional intelligence spectrum generally, right? And the social skills spectrum.
Sure, that's a stereotype.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's true. I don't know what your experience is, but then again, when it comes to, you know, like subjective questions probably aren't the best to give to a group of engineers anyway, right?
Probably not.
Yeah. Because, I mean, nothing is more meaningless to a group of engineers than what color that fucking internet dress is.
Yeah, what would be even worse is a question that was worded, how blue do you think the dress is? Very or not really? What?
I can totally see, though. I can't see you actually standing up and shouting this, but I can see you thinking about standing up and shouting, you know, that you disagree with the entire premise of the whole questioning. Right now, I disagree fully with what you're doing here. I can see it, what's coming, and I disagree.
Yeah. I mean, fundamentally, I agreed with the message that they were communicating. But when it came to them testing and scoring, I was not on board with it.
Have you ever taken the any of a variation of what kind of learner are you tests?
Not ringing a bell.
I mean, depending on what, you know, whose class you go to or whatever, there's like a type 1, 2, 3, and 4 learners. Sometimes there's some sort of recognized scale about like there's a bunch of letters that are sort of similar. About your personality as far as, you know, your...
I think you're talking about the Myers-Briggs personality test.
Yeah. This is a variation on that. This is actually more of a, what kind of learner are you? But it's sort of based on your personality. What was funny was, you know, most of us in this training class were the don't spend a lot of time reading to us. Let's just get on with it. Come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. We're impatient. We're just like, come on, let's go, let's go, let's go. Like, where is this going? Tell us to stop wasting our time. And so all of us people in that group were like, well, of course, that's just how people are. I mean, if you're not like that, you're, you know, whatever, you're a weirdo. But let me tell you, the 3 people that were like the number 1 and the 5 people that were listed as number 2s and the 7 people that were number 4s, they were so delighted to finally find a home in their own personality. It's like,
I bet.
It's like a religious experience. It's like, well, of course this is the way I learn because this is the way I want to teach and this is the way everything should be. And why not? You know, you have to have a million questions and answer every single one of the questions. And I want you to show me and demonstrate how to do it. And then ask me again. And then we'll go have lunch and then we'll come back and we'll talk about it again. And then we'll try it out. Anyway. If we're just talking, if we're trying to apply this to, okay, now you have a trainee that has a different learning style than you do, and how do you appeal to them? I can see where that kind of thing helps. But at a certain point...
Yeah, were you the one that gave me the book Quiet for Christmas a couple years ago?
Maybe. Probably only if you requested it, though.
I don't think I did. But yeah. I got two copies of it that year.
Yeah, no, I'm not really one to give out pointed gifts lately.
Great book, though. I recommend it.
Yeah, okay. It's called Quiet, and what's it about?
It's about how introverts fit into a world that tends to value extroverted characteristics more.
And it has real-world application?
Yes.
Well, this movie, The American, starring George Clooney, teaches us that being introverted is very important, at least in his line of work. And the least bit of actually outside contact and friend making is a detriment and should be avoided.
Yes.
Because as evidence,
and Jack knows this, which is why he dispatched his lady friend at the first sign of trouble.
Yeah, in Sweden, Ingrid found out the hard way that this is how Jack lives. And then Jack dispatches the other of the pair of assassins that have come after him. And then he flies off to Rome.
Yeah, he has a really interesting assassin style, I guess. It's something that you don't see very often the way it's depicted in movies, but it actually, from an economy of motion, which goes along with his economy of speech, it makes a lot of sense. You don't see it very much. But when he's advancing on a target and he gets close enough where he decides to open fire, he actually doesn't stop advancing. So maybe it doesn't look as dramatic as if he were to stop, aim, and take out his foe. But when he just keeps walking towards whoever he's going after and while shooting, it makes a lot of sense.
Oh yeah, plus he doesn't stop shooting. It's not like he takes one great shot and then and puts his pistol barrel in the air and blows the smoke out of the barrel. He continues to advance, shooting the whole time. You're not getting up.
Yeah, he doesn't subscribe to the Murtaugh notion of shoot him in the leg so you can question them. He's full on rigs.
Oh, absolutely. So he ends up going to Rome and contacts his handler, Pavel, who insists that he can't stay in Rome. And Pavel actually says, hey, so who is this woman in Sweden? And he says, it was a friend. And Pavel's like, well, you need to go to Italy and maybe don't make friends anymore. Now, but I'm going to call this Italy the entire time. Please don't tell me they're in Spain.
No, they're in Italy. Although okay. I was really geographically challenged watching this movie.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's, I'm gonna try to throw some pronunciation in here occasionally, and it's probably gonna come out wrong, but, it was beautiful. That's the nice thing about having this location is it's absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, I mean, the first time I watched the movie, I didn't realize that Jack goes to a whole different town when he goes to the first place that Pavel sends him, and without saying anything, he just gets a weird vibe, doesn't like it. So he goes to another little town in Italy without ever telling Pavel, I think, and he gets rid of his cell phone. So I understood that he didn't like the initial location, but when I watched it the first time, I had no idea that he actually went to a whole new town.
Yeah, a whole new town, yeah. Though within, like, if you're at the top of the hill, it's the visual, like, you can see the other town.
Right.
So, he was initially sent to Castelvecchio, yeah, a small town in the mountains of Abruzzo. And instead, he doesn't like it. He doesn't like it at all. So he takes his little Fiat Tempra and throws his cell phone out the window and drives to Castel del Monte, just down the block. And then he gets a little apartment, and you know that he's not supposed to make friends, but instantly he is sort of confronted by a priest, Father Benedetto, who welcomes him and invites him to dinner and says, look, if you have any questions, you know, what do you do for a living? Jack says he's a photographer. He's like, oh, well, if you want to know about the town, you ask the priest, you know. And Father Benedetto is, he's very outgoing. He doesn't take no for an answer.
He is definitely the extrovert to counter Jack's introverted tendencies. He also seems to have a thing for trying to rescue lost souls, and he immediately senses that Jack is a lost soul.
Yeah. Well, and if you have that thing, being a priest is probably a good place for you in the world. Now, when you first watched this movie, did you think that perhaps Father Benedetto was going to come to a rather bad end?
I thought he was either going to come to a bad end or he was going to be the one who ended Jack.
Yeah, yeah. At first I was a little worried that he was going to be the final target. The other thing, by the way, there's this little side note where there are prostitutes being killed. I was pretty sure that either Father Benedetto or perhaps even Jack was killing prostitutes during this movie.
That's funny. I thought maybe Fabio, is that the mechanic?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that could have been. Yeah. There weren't very many characters in this little drama.
Yeah, in a more Americanized version of this movie, you wouldn't be allowed to have characters who are just there to be supporting characters. They would have to be more involved in the main plot somehow. So I really did enjoy that about this movie, that they were just there to add flavor, and that was it.
And there were moments in this movie where, well, okay, so to get back to the plot for a second, just to give us where we're at here. So he goes, and while he's in Castel del Monte, he contacts Pavel, who is upset that he's not answering his phone, and Pavel gives him another job. And you get the sense that Jack is some kind of contract killer, but that's not necessarily true, because in this movie, he doesn't assassinate anybody. His job is he's an armorer. He makes weapons for you spy assassins or hitmen.
Yeah, I mean, I think he is an assassin, because Pavel tells him that this job, he won't even have to pull the trigger.
Well, yeah, I suppose you're right there, yeah. But it's a very kind of David Morrell setting, don't you think?
Yeah, I didn't consider that, but I can see that. It's probably one of the reasons I like this movie so much. But it makes a lot of sense that if you are in such a specialized line of work that you would probably need to learn how to craft your own tools.
And you're probably, again, you're very particular in what you do and how you do it. And you know, you have to know all aspects of your, again, very narrow field. So,
yeah.
So this job, he has to make a weapon, a very specific weapon, and he's never told what it's going to be or who it's going to be used on, but he has a series of questions. He asks the person who wants this weapon, which, by the way, is Matilda, who is played by Thekla Rutin. I'm probably pronouncing her name wrong. And again, she's Marie, the very pregnant co-owner of the hotel in Bruges. And she's very tall and very skinny and very pretty and very cold. She's everything you want in Italy in an assassin.
Yeah, after their conversation, they do something that I normally don't like in movies, but I really appreciated this time. They had a really technical conversation about the specs for the weapon that Jack needed to create. And then, this is the part I usually don't like, to dumb it down for the audience, Jack summarizes.
I'm Edward.
Matilda.
Range?
150 to 175 meters.
Time?
5 seconds, 7 at the most.
Targets?
1.
Firing rate?
Rapid.
Magazine capacity?
Large, preferably a 5.56. The weapon must be fairly light and compact.
How compact?
As compact as possible.
You want an automatic rifle to fit inside a woman's purse?
A small vanity case would be permissible.
A small briefcase would be possible. Noise?
Silencer.
I can only give you a suppressor. It'll dampen the decibels and dislocate the sound source. I'll reduce the muzzle flash. Can't make you silent, but I can make you invisible as long as you're willing to lose some range.
Ecco il suo americano.
Grazie.
can accept a slight loss of range.
You want a weapon, the firing capacity of a submachine gun and the range of a rifle.
Can you do it?
I like the Matilda character because she's a professional also, and you have to have a certain amount of charm to be in that profession, apparently. I mean, Jack has a certain charm, although it's tempered by his desire not to make any kind of lasting relationships. And of course, you get a sense of, you know, he knows who he's dealing with, so he's certainly not going to like have some sort of romantic encounter with this woman. But
right, I wouldn't say Jack has charm. I would say he has more of he's got a quiet charisma. You know, he's handsome and he doesn't talk much, so people tend to fill in their own story with him.
That's true. You're right. It's charisma. It's not charm, and he's certainly not pouring it on. And he lives a very kind of Spartan lifestyle. I mean, you get to see, you know, his little apartment. You know, he's basically doing like simple like push-ups and pull-ups and things to keep himself fit, and he's got a very utilitarian lifestyle, very minimalist.
Yeah, did you almost expect him to have like an eyeball-sized mirror on the wall?
I did. I was expecting him to check the eyeball-sized mirror. Also, the one thing I did not like about this, by the way, the whole thing of his character was fine. I didn't mind any of it. In fact, some of it we'll talk about a little later, I thought was really brilliant. But the fact that the tattoo on his arm looked like it had been freshly painted in Sharpie really, really bothered me.
The tattoos in this movie were pretty weak.
Yeah. It's like, come on, you could have done better. I mean, tattoos look weathered pretty quickly.
And there's no way Hitman Jack has a butterfly tattoo on the back of his neck.
That's the thing, though. That gives him his only piece of humanity, really. And you don't even, I mean, I don't know about you, but except for there, you know, cause there's a two scenes at the end where you see actual butterflies, and you see one scene where he's reading a book. He falls asleep reading a book of butterflies. They don't really talk about butterflies very much.
No.
I mean, again, it's his only humanizing thing.
I don't think I agree with you there, but we can also get into that later.
Okay. Yeah, so he has a job. His job is to make this special gun. And it's going to, you know, it's going to take a little bit of time, and he's got a certain amount of time to do it in, and it's going to take some materiel. So some of it gets mailed, and some of it he obtains from Fabio, who is recommended to him by Father Benedetto, because Fabio runs like a mechanic shop.
Which also might be like a chop shop, right?
Yeah. However, I guess as soon as the priest let him in, he's like, my shop is your shop, which I thought was a little strange.
Yeah, that was weird. I didn't know if that was a criminal can spot other criminals and he was willing to help him out, or if it was just because he dropped Father Benedetto's name when he said he wanted some work done on his car.
Yeah, and, you know, he did mention that he needed some other parts, so he went around and grabbed some bearings and other kind of parts from the shop and made himself a handy silencer. Or suppressor. It's not a silencer. It's a suppressor.
Yeah, I really enjoyed his construction scenes.
Oh, yeah, you get the scenes of him. He's got, like, the table in his apartment that would be like a dining table. It's actually all set up with, like the modified, was like the thing you put a handheld drill in to make it into like a drill press, and a vise and like a little anvil kind of thing.
And he has to do some hammering. And I really like the touch that he waited for the time of day when the church bells rang out so that when he did his hammering, no one would be able to hear it.
Yeah, it was very... Again, I found this to be both David Morrell and also William Deal. I wish there's a book called Chameleon that's about an assassin, and it was written by William Deal, who was probably best known for Primal Fear. And I wish it was available on audio, because I have a very fond memory.
I remember that book.
Yeah. There was a guy who makes a silencer out of a potato, which apparently doesn't necessarily work in real life.
It made for a good image, though.
Yeah, well, and you'll see both movies, and I think in real life you can see pictures of people with, like, inside cars with lots of, like, pieces of potato around them. I think soda bottles, too, are not necessarily the best thing you want to use for that sort of thing.
Right.
Oh, there's... Journey and I did some YouTube videos the other day where we got into a little hole, and I can't remember... Oh, I know what it was. It was these guys who were putting random... Well, not random, but putting dangerous things into a microwave. Like, they microwaved a CD, and they microwaved... what else did they microwave? Somebody microwaved a cell phone. A bar of soap, by the way, is really impressive when you microwave it. They did an incandescent light bulb, not a fluorescent light bulb, an incandescent light bulb. Pretty scary. They also did, we saw another video where these guys took those, glow sticks and put them in the microwave, and glow sticks.
Activated or non-activated?
No, activated.
Mm-hmm.
And glow sticks in the microwave are impressive. They are like, it looks like they're like 20 times as bright when they're heated up.
Freaky.
Yeah, well, that's all great, except that you see this one kid who does the same trick, and he's like filming it obviously on his like cheaper video camera, and he takes it out of the microwave, and it's really glowing, really nice. He's like, ah, this is awesome. And then he starts to shake it a little bit, you know, and it explodes and gets like all over him and like in his mouth, and it's burning his face.
Yeah.
But it's really pretty. And it didn't hurt him. It just more scared him. And I'm sure it hurt a little bit, but it didn't permanently damage him. But it was super pretty because it's all this glowing stuff that has now exploded all over your shirt. In fact, his friend that comes to his aid, like from another part of the house, I think, says, "What happened?" And then he says, "Your good shirt." So, so the lesson.
If you're going to be on camera, you need to wear your good shirt.
Well, exactly. Yeah. So the lesson to my daughter was, we're going to watch some stuff that you should never do. So,
it's a good lesson. If we'd had YouTube when we were kids, we would have. Never had to witness our father putting a fluorescent light bulb in the microwave while we were eating dinner.
Oh, no, we would have. Are you kidding? No, our father is a hands-on kind of guy. He would have mimicked the test. In fact, I'm afraid to tell him about microwaving the glow sticks.
Yeah, please don't.
Yeah. Sorry, back to the movie. Lots of tangents. I apologize. This is a very lingering film. And normally, I mean, I think you had mentioned before... because I had suggested that Miami Vice was way too slow, that you were maybe concerned that I was going to be disappointed in the speed of this movie or the pace of this movie.
Yeah. I mean, if I told you this was another one of those 50-50 movies, or I think you'll either love it or you'll hate it, without much in between. Cause I think if you can't get on board with the leisurely pace of this movie and kind of the somber mood throughout, and there's no way you can get through it liking it.
True. Yeah. You'll know in the first 15 minutes whether you're going to like this movie, because it takes a while until things really heat up. In fact, like pretty much, I mean, like the whole movie is fairly economical when it comes to the action too. The action comes, it's fast and it's hard, but it doesn't usually last very long.
Yeah, I mean, in a parallel way to the sex in the movie.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, the sex is a little rough.
And, like other things, economic.
Yeah. No, and I'm not saying not fun. Well, okay, because we do have a love interest, and that's, you know, Jack can't make friends, so he's going to go and get a prostitute. And that's where we meet Clara, played by the aforementioned Violante Placido. And this is the only, well, I don't know, I guess there are a couple of cliches, but of course, you know, even though he is not charming to her, luckily he's such a good lover that she's pleased with him. Plus, she likes his tattoo on his back, or back of his neck.
Yeah, there's a scene... There's a scene that I thought was really funny because it reminded me of of getting a haircut. So he goes to the brothel, and he first visits a prostitute named Clara, and we find out in a later scene that he's a one prostitute kind of guy, because he shows up and he asks where Clara is, and the girls tell him that she's not working, and he's offered up a variety of choices instead, and he just leaves. And I don't know if you get your haircut at a barber shop or if you go to like an actual like haircutting salon or something. But I find barbershops really stressful for me, because, you know, the ones that have multiple barbers, then you can go and sit, and whoever is open when you come up in line, you go to that barber. And I always want to go to the same guy. But at the same time, I don't want to be one of those who's like, no, I'm waiting for him. Because then I feel bad for the barber I dissed. So I was proud of Jack for just being able to walk away and wait for Clara.
So I've never been to a barber. I always go to a beauty operator or a hairstylist or whatever they... A beauty operator is what our grandmother called them. So I like to say that. My mother-in-law is actually... a trained cosmetologist. I always call her a cosmonaut because that's what I do. So I always, you know, I've gone to basically a series of long-term hair relationships. And one time in particular, I don't know exactly how I got her, but she was not a great hairstylist. In fact, I could pretty much count, and we even had a joking understanding that about half of my haircuts were going to be okay, like good. And the other half were going to be, not great. But because of familiarity and the fact that you could go in and by the third or fourth haircut, like she knew what I wanted. And so we went in and we had a nice little fun conversation, and she cut my hair. And again, half the time it was just fine. So, and we already knew what the price was going to be. So that was all fine. So, as all relationships, I will tend to take them for granted. And so when this particular hairstylist left the state to avoid prosecution, by the way.
For what?
For assault on a police officer, as it turns out. It's not as...
Him with their car or something?
No, that would have been like a felony assault. This was more of a misdemeanor assault. There may have been some other things going on that I didn't need to know about, which is good. In fact, actually, it's funny. When she left, I went to the same shop, and I got one of the other girls in the shop, and I was fairly new where I worked, and I didn't know what to say if people asked where I worked, because, you know, I didn't want to give them the wrong impression. So I was like, okay, this is what I do. She goes, oh, do you know blah, blah, blah? Well, yeah, you know, I know him. And then she made like a reference to the size of his penis. It was a positive reference. I mean, as far as it was flattering, but I did not need to know these things. Like, oh yeah, I went to high school with him. Yeah. They called him blah, 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 blah. I'm like, oh, I didn't even know that at all. And he must get his pants tailored, but that's all that, but. At that point, I realized, okay, I need to like start fishing outside of this particular pond. And I went through like a series of like one night stand hair relationships. It was very uncomfortable, because you realize that, okay, so I knew we went in, we already knew each other. We knew exactly what was going to happen from the beginning to the end. There was no real surprises. Occasionally there'd be some funny things that would happen, and we have like a nice interaction, sort of social intercourse and everything. But then suddenly you go to strangers and they ask you, you know, well, what do you want? You know, what do you like? Well, I don't know what I like. I like what the last lady did. Well, what did she do? Well, I don't know. I'm not the professional. I don't even know the terminology to use. So my current hairstylist, who I love, by the way, a coworker actually wanted me to go to her, partly because she wanted to set me up with her, because this hairstylist was just, she was sort of led a wild kind of lifestyle, and she was just looking for a nice Christian man. And I found that amusing.
You fit the bill. Yeah, you fit the bill.
Well, I fit the bill, sort of.
At least half of it.
Yeah, I mean, I was, you know, I'm pretty nice and a fairly... I mean, I'm certainly not, I don't live a wild lifestyle. I'm fairly monastic, really, when I was single. just that last bar was a problem. Anyway, turns out that I probably failed the hello test. So that was no big surprise to anybody, I don't think. But she's a fantastic hair person. And now, again, I have a long-term hair relationship. So I can't conceive of going into a barbershop or a brothel. Because, yeah, you're in line and you're like do I be strictly transactional? You know, and I don't even know, like, barbershop culture. Like, if you're waiting in line, yeah, there must be some pressure just to sit down or whoever next, right? I mean, you said so.
Well, that's my pressure. There were certainly people who were like, no, I'm waiting for Juan.
Well, but you have at least the minimum amount of emotional intelligence. So you knew enough that it was, you know, might be a problem.
Oh, yeah. No. Yeah. I was fully aware.
Yeah.
But yeah, I eventually had to migrate to the solo barbershop just so I wouldn't have to deal with all that social pressure.
Like a one stool guy?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Pat's barbershop in Spinard.
Oh, sweet. You like Pat?
His name wasn't Pat.
Ah, okay.
I did. I really liked him. He was great. Cause I could go in there. He usually had the TV on to whatever news channel he was liking that day. And he never talked. He was not one for small talk. Neither was I. So I'd sit down. He asked me how short I wanted it in numbers, which I love.
Excellent.
So I could be very precise. I like the number 2 up the sides and back and off my forehead and front. That was it. Their barbershops are cheap. I think he charged like $13 a haircut.
Wow.
And after I found out how much my wife pays for her hair, I never felt bad about just giving him a 20 after that.
Oh, yeah. And, no, not at all.
Yeah. And so he was always really happy. I never want to change. And it was great. We never had to talk. But then he sold the place. And the guy who bought it was a creepy weirdo.
And the last thing you want is to go into a one-chair barbershop with a creepy weirdo.
Yeah, so I was really distraught about having to find a new barber after that.
And you have found one?
Yeah, I found one closer to my house. He was an old Mexican dude named Lehi.
Ah, well.
Although I'm getting a little concerned because during my last haircut, he didn't seem right. And then he proceeded to tell me about how he's trying to get used to his trifocals.
Well, I mean, I imagine
that he got in Mexico along with a bunch of dental work.
Well, can I presume that he's from Mexico at least?
Yeah.
Okay, at least, I mean, because I have a different, I mean, going to Mexico, if you're Mexican, to get your dental work and stuff done, I consider different than going to Mexico if you're like an American and you're just doing basically medical tourism.
Yeah, no, he goes and visits his family every Christmas and gets all his medical, dental, and optical work done.
You know, I got it. That's great. I say more power to Lehi. I was gonna recommend my hair person to you, but I don't think if you just want to come in and give numbers and sit in silence, this is not gonna happen. Yeah. She is great. It's always like it's kind of like a haircut in a show. And by the way, she gives me 100% good haircuts. I've never had a bad haircut with her.
Nice.
In fact,
barbershops are great. Although sometimes you got to be careful. They'll try and give you a shoulder massage if you're not careful.
Yeah, I don't want that. And stay away from me with your warm towels. Have you ever had a shave done?
I have not.
Yeah, me either. I can't imagine. Don't want it. In fact, when my hair person clipped my the eyebrow lick I have like a little cowlick in my eyebrow, I consider that my lucky eyebrow. But no, she came out with this pair of scissors and clipped it off. And I'm like, don't do that. Don't. I don't want to be touched where I don't want to be touched. And I don't be snipping off my lucky parts. Okay. So what other hair stories do you have? You know, actually, it's funny.
I've got lots. So we can get back to the movie.
Oh, man. You know, hairstylists are the best. Because that, I mean, other than being an actual, like, merchant marine and dealing with for real pirates, that's as close as I will ever get, is going into the world of hairstylists and asking them to tell me a story. Because it is some crazy, like, last time we took, I took Journey, and Kelly and Journey and I all went in Kelly gets her hair done with somebody completely different, but at a different shop. But she wanted to be there to make sure that she got what she wanted on Journey, because the place we used to go to, just specifically for kids, basically, well, they closed down. So suddenly it was like being a barbershop. So when I told my hairstylist this, she's like, oh, and she tells her, I think her husband, who's Dominican, and she's like, yeah, you know, the Dominicans, you know, bought that. They own all of them there, and it's all great. And they do have kind of, you know, they're Dominican, so they do have kind of some issues. Like, they're not always completely licensed properly. Okay, good to know.
Wow, all right.
Yeah, turns out, well, actually, one of my coworkers, she's not only a cosmonaut, but she may still serve on the board of cosmetology and cosmetology, beautician and tattooing board for the state of Alaska. Like, their group would come in and shut you down if they found out that you were giving like treatments where you would have fish eat the dead skin on your feet.
Oh yeah.
Cause that is not hygienic. Anyway, back to this movie, because Jack may go to a brothel, but he never does get his hair cut or shaved or waxed or anything in this movie. There's no other beautician stuff going on.
That's for sure.
Yeah. He keeps his hair very short, which is important for an assassin and during the zombie apocalypse. So he ends up going to meet Matilda to show her this weapon he has made. And they test it. And it's a nice little scene where she's impressed by the craftsmanship, but asks him to make a few more adjustments. So he agrees to that, and plus he has to make some special exploding ammunition for her.
Mercury will be just fine.
Yes. And that's when we learn that if you carefully drill a hole in the head of a bullet, whatever that's called, and put mercury in it, apparently there may be some other steps they're not telling us, but it will explode when you shoot it.
I hope there are other steps.
It's true. You never know. Yeah. So we get scenes of him making this thing, and then he actually bumps into Clara outside of her work, and she basically invites him on a date.
She very cleverly forces him to ask her out,
and he does, and they have this nice little dinner. Although it's sort of funny because it's, I don't know, it seemed a little bit of like mixed signals or whatever. Like, she invited him out, you know, he invited her to a non brothel encounter, but she wanted to make it clear, you know, when the guy came over the flowers, that, you know, that they needed to disabuse him of the notion that they were a couple.
Yeah, I read that as she didn't want to be presumptuous and seem super clingy, so she was trying to give him an opportunity to have as much distance as he wanted. I didn't see it as mixed signals. I saw it as her trying not to push.
Luckily, she's very charming. And, you know, it turns out this is George Clooney. So he has, again, he's very charismatic. This is all intercut with visits to Father Benedetto, where they have dinner and stuff. And they talk about the meaning of life and whatnot. And actually, Father Benedetto had a very interesting thing where they talked about, because actually Jack confronts him at one point about Fabio being his son.
Buongiorno. You're up early.
I need some air.
I walk here to meditate. I thank God for certain favors he has granted me. And I ask him to look after those of my friends who are sinners.
All men are sinners.
Some are greater sinners than others, but those who seek peace have much sinning in their history.
Maybe.
Forgive me, this is the priest in me speaking, but you have done much sinning, Señor Clark, and you still do. Something happened here last night.
Everything I've done, I've had good cause to do.
Do you wish to tell me?
To confess?
Yes.
For what reason?
For your own sake. Perhaps I can pray for you.
Perhaps.
I wonder how many bastards have been made here. You work in metal. You were given some steel by Fabio, the car doctor.
Where was he conceived, Father? Fabio, the car doctor.
Why do you ask me that?
You have each other's photos. You have each other's eyes. Was he conceived here, under the trees at night, like all the other bastards?
I do not remember, Signore. It was many years ago. In the end, it is I who confesses to you.
You want me to do the same?
For your own good. You cannot doubt the existence of hell. You live in it. It is a place without love. Perhaps I have no right to wear these robes, but they do have a heart full of a father's love. Something close to his heart. And for that, I'm both grateful and happy. What do you have, my friend?
Father Benedetto tells him that, you know, he has no doubt in the existence of hell because we live in it. And, you know, from a theological standpoint, I think that's an interesting way to look at things.
And from a life standpoint, that's a pretty dark philosophy.
Kind of, but it gives you hope. I mean, that's the one thing that religion gives is hope. Oh, okay, perhaps there are other things. Sorry, I don't mean to completely dismissive of all religion, but I thought, and also, like, it's impressed upon Jack that this is a special kind of hell where if you're living in a place without love, so without love, then you are truly living in hell. And that's where Jack has to confront his inner feelings about, you know, love and stuff.
Yeah, you can tell he's really digging his new lady friend, even though Pablo made it very clear that when you make friends, bad things start to happen.
Plus, Pavel talks to Jack several times during the whole thing, but Jack finds out that people are following him, and he talks to Pavel about how the Swedes have possibly found him, and he's becoming progressively paranoid, Jack is. And Pavel tells him, look, it's because you've lost your touch. Pavel is not the cheerleading kind of boss.
No. Pavel's definitely more of a sticky guy. He's not a carrot guy.
Exactly. So Jack knows people are following him, and he even becomes suspicious of Clara when he finds that she has a gun in her purse.
Yeah, well, at one point, the blonde dude who's following him actually... So Jack's seen him around quite a bit, and then one night on his way home, he actually starts like following him on foot, and Jack realizes that he's about to try to kill him. So this is probably like the biggest action scene of the whole movie right there, is Jack eludes him and gets a drop on him, and then loses him and has to chase him down with a automobile versus a scooter chase, and ends up killing him by breaking his neck. So
yeah, after basically he makes him crash the car by shooting at him, then he has to lay down his scooter. He's, you know, he's sore the next day.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he knows that people are after him. He knows that the whoever the Swedes were.
Yeah. And Pavel, when he talks to Pavel about it, Pavel doesn't seem to be too concerned about who the Swedes are. And I think that starts to make Jack suspicious of Pavel.
Yeah. Which turns out is a good place to be. I mean, he may be paranoid, but it serves him well.
Yeah, he's paranoid, but he's not wrong.
No, not at all. And luckily,
that's one of the things I really liked about his performance is the way he portrays his paranoia and how it colors not only every relationship he has in the movie, but it informs basically every action he takes, and you really get to see how it wears on him, and not like a melodramatic way. I mean, there are a couple of scenes of him sleeping, not very comfortably, but, just the tension that he carries in his shoulders all the time because he is never sure, you know, if his next interaction with Matilda is going to end with her trying to kill him, or even if Carla is somehow involved in the plot. Sorry, Clara. I keep calling her Carla. Is even involved in the plot to kill him. And it's nothing that he ever says out loud, but just the way he looks around the room and the way he looks suspicious of people, you can tell it's a miserable existence. He is terrified all the time. Even though he's probably the most dangerous guy in the room, wherever he is, he's running scared through the whole movie.
Oh yeah, there is no peace for him. He is always, even when he's in his little apartment, he is like peeking through the windows and has to be very, very, he's never in condition white. He always has to be on alert. He also has a very nice way of, he has these facial expressions of him thinking and deliberating before he does stuff. And it really gives you in just a quick second, the idea that the Jack really is deliberating every step he makes in this movie. Like he is not, he's not sure of anything he's doing, but he is like doing the math in his head about, okay, this is the situation. All right. So this calls for the solution.
Yeah. He's thoughtful about each of his actions and he is mindful of the dire consequences if he's wrong.
Unfortunately though, Jack is falling in love with the lovely Clara, the hooker with a heart of gold. And they have a tense scene on the same riverbank where he had tested his rifle. In fact, her stepping on a shell casing or whatever that was in the, I guess it's more of a creek than a river. I thought that was a little bit over the top, but it worked out fine.
Yeah, they didn't linger on it.
But then it is followed by a very tense moment where she is laying out in the sun and goes to grab her little purse that he knows has a gun in it. And so he has stashed a gun in the picnic basket. And so it's a tense moment where he thinks he's going to have to shoot her. Luckily, though, we have a reverse jump scare and she just asks him to put on some sunscreen on her.
Yeah, and what I really liked about the editing of this movie is there was a fight that happened after that where he confronts her about having the gun. But what they did is they cut all that out and they cut right to the end of the fight where they're getting in the car and having their last words with each other, which is great because you get all you need to know out of it without having to witness the actual fight, which would have just, it would not have been a unique moment in cinema history.
No. And it would have slowed things down. Because, you know, you need you're going to get from A to C. You don't need to have the B.
Right. And I think this movie trusts its audience enough to jump there,
yeah.
Which I really appreciated.
Yeah, me too. So he has his final delivery. His weapon is complete. All the adjustments have been made. He has prepared the ammunition to specification. And he calls up Pavel and says, okay, you know, I actually asked for a couple days. That's when he goes out and has his little date on the riverbank with Clara. But he is delivering this weapon to Matilda, and he tells Pavel that that's his last job. He's out.
Yeah, and he doesn't get a warm and fuzzy reaction from Pavel when he says that.
No. And you know what I like about this movie? Another touch I thought was great. I like the fact that he had a hot glue gun on that desk, because he's... he's instructed to put the weapon into a small briefcase, or he said he's going to put this weapon in a small briefcase so it can be, you know, concealed. And so he makes this, he buys a briefcase and he makes like a false top to put over the gun so it looks like it's just full of like office supplies and whatnot. And it's all hot glued in there. And it's just a quick scene. I mean, you don't see him making that. You just see him like taking the whole one piece thing and placing it on top of the gun. So you didn't really need to see the hot glue gun on the desk, on the table. But the fact that it was there, because all the equipment he's using changes as what he's doing changes. So they were very thoughtful when it came to like set dressing, this particular aspect of it, which I thought I was really happy about.
There's nice detail in this movie.
Yeah. So he does not get a warm, fuzzy feeling from Pavel. so therefore he doesn't get a super warm, fuzzy feeling about the whole thing. And so he goes back into the briefcase and makes a little adjustment, and then goes to meet Matilda.
Yeah, so when you're watching this, I don't know if you watched it more than once, but at least the first time you're watching, did you try and figure out what he was doing with that last adjustment? Did you have any thoughts?
I was pretty sure that the adjustment was going to render the gun, well, at least inoperative in one sense. I did not know what was going to happen, nor do I know how he accomplished what eventually happens.
I'm glad they didn't show us how to do that.
That's true. It's awfully dangerous. I suppose that would have been irresponsible. I mean, I knew that he was sabotaging this gun. I did not know how it was going to end up. Again, it becomes a very William Deal, David Morrell kind of situation, though. And again, storytelling in a small cast of characters in a sort of a tight location with a very sort of simple plot really works out well. You'll hear a podcast where we talk about Star Trek, the motion picture. That was the movie I watched before watching this movie this week.
How'd that work out for you?
Well, there were some great things in Star Trek, the motion picture, but pacing was not one of them. So this was a completely appropriately paced movie. Again, it showed his craft, but I don't think it like fetishized his craft. It showed that he was very precise. He was a craftsman, but they didn't do like a 30-second pan of like the gun barrel or anything like they would in, a Star Trek movie. So he delivers his gun in this very tense scene where he pretty much figures that Matilda is going to try to shoot him.
And he's right.
Yeah, but she doesn't. It turns out because a busload of children show up outside the meeting place. And so it would be, be irresponsible for either of them to start shooting at one another.
Yeah, and he does just enough to make the situation awkward for Matilda. So she can't really get a drop on him. You know, he's never quite where she expects him to be. So he does just enough to make sure that she can't do it cleanly. And as a professional, she's not going to do it sloppily.
So, and that's where it just becomes very clear, because she gets a call from Pavel that asks if she's killed him, and she says that she hasn't had the opportunity yet. So now it's clear that Pavel has ordered the hit on Jack.
Now, did you think that was the end game the entire time for the rifle? Do you think that they were having him make his own implement of death?
Do I think so now? I'm still not sure. It could have been an opportunity that Pavel saw, but it seems like Matilda knew from the beginning. Although one would think that, you know, she had an opportunity to take him out when they were testing the rifle.
Right.
So I don't know. What do you think?
I think the rifle was for some other job.
And this was just a convenient opportunity for Pavel?
Right. Yeah, I think he was, killing two birds with one stone.
Yeah.
Getting a good weapon and connecting Jack with his demise.
So do you think Pavel was involved with the Sweden thing?
I do.
Okay. So, me too. I mean, so, and again, this is a very small movie, so we don't know anything that's happened before this.
Yeah, there's no backstory for Jack or Pavel. It's very Michael Mann that way. Just no backstory. They just go right into it and you're informed of the characters by their actions.
Yeah. You don't need it. And so we end up with a scene at whatever the religious holiday is, where there's a parade. And again, I wasn't sure whether the priest might have been the target, but we know now that Matilda's going to get Jack anyway. So Jack meets up with Clara, and Jack's got his envelope full of money anyway. And she has already professed that she wanted to return home with him, but he told her, no, you can't come to my house. That's not appropriate. Not going to happen. But when he greets her, he says, hey, you know, why don't you run away with me? Why don't we run away together? And she's pretty excited by the prospect. And they kiss. And that's when Matilda climbs up on a rooftop and sights him in and fires the shot that should have killed him, but instead blows half her own face off.
I thought that was a great twist when I watched the movie the first time. I didn't necessarily see that coming.
Oh, not at all.
But yeah, Jack sabotaged the rifle in a way that caused the bullet to explode in her face.
Yeah, which again is pretty amazing. And so he runs to her, and again, you know, you're right. The economy of motion he does, you know, he's not a ninja. He's pretty matter-of-factly running toward her, but he's also, you know, running toward her armed. So he has his gun out. He's ready to go.
Yeah, and George Clooney, in his later years, he runs like somebody who has back issues.
Yeah, this last scene especially, I really liked the way he ran. Not so much after this, but after he has his shootout with Pavel. He and Pavel end up meeting. He gives Clara the envelope and says to meet him at the river. And then he goes after and finds out who, the dying words of Matilda about who set him up. And that's when the priest comes up and he apologizes to the priest, but leaves the priest with the dead body. Luckily, the priest knows what to do with the dead body. You know, he's got a whole routine on it. I'm sure there's like memos and things. So we have this, a quick little gunfight in an Italian alleyway or roadway where Pavel is killed. So Jack,
a very short shootout.
Yeah. Very short.
Two shots are fired.
Yep. And so, Jack having killed Pavel, Jack runs, jumps in his car, and he's going to meet Clara by the river. And she's, you know, again, this is the culmination of everything. So he's all full of adrenaline, and you can tell, and, you know, he's been angsty the whole movie. Not angsty, he's been, you know, on edge the whole movie. And so he's driving to meet Clara, and you could have told by the walk, because I think he did the walk really well when he walked, like, sort of jogged quickly to the car. But you find out in the car that, oh, yeah, he's been shot. So he drives what is probably a considerable distance to this little river, and the whole while...
Yeah, he does a great job. You're going to comment on his shrinking?
Yeah, and also his anguish.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's like, no, this is not how this is supposed to work out. This is, you know, this is just the wrong thing. Everything could have worked out fine except this one little snag. Oh, yeah, the snag is that I'm probably going to die.
Yeah, it was the anguish of being so close.
Yeah.
But knowing instantly he was not going to make it.
And he gets to the river. And Clara sees him and runs over to him, and that's where he collapses in the steering wheel.
He sees her long enough to smile, and then he collapses.
And a white endangered butterfly flits skyward from his car, and we fade to black in credits.
Yeah, kind of a bummer ending, right?
Kinda. I like the fact that it doesn't spell out what happens. I mean, you kind of know what happens, but it leaves it right at that moment where anything is possible.
Yeah, I mean, it's not quite as bad as when you made me read Testament by Dave Morrell.
I remember the first part of Testament, but I'm guessing everybody dies at the end.
Well, you should revisit it. That's my gift to you.
Okay. I remember I was going through a lot of phases where I loved the fact that any book where everybody dies at the end was good to me.
It's been a long time since I read it, but my memory is... Yeah, it's a bit of a redemption story because the main character really goes through his own personal journey through hell. And then when he comes out the other side and he gets his opportunity to enact his revenge, there's the whole moment of, you know, I want to do this, but I know I shouldn't do it, you know, to save my own soul. And then he's just like, fuck it, and does it anyway.
You know, there is a Stephen King book that it was a part of the books that were released under Richard Bachman that you can't actually buy. Like it was part of a 4-book collection you could buy together. Thinner was about the only one you could buy on its own. And then once it was determined, I mean, once they released that Stephen King was Richard Bachman, they released like all 4 like novellas, I think, in one. And they're all pretty good. You know, a little bit off from the normal Stephen King thing, but one is called The Rage, and it's basically about a school shooter, and he's not entirely unsympathetic, which is why Stephen King's like, no, this isn't going to be available anymore. Sorry, guys. It would be irresponsible to have published this book anymore.
Yikes.
Did you ever either read the book or see the movie Apt Pupil?
I saw the movie.
Yeah. The book, after I saw the movie, I read the book again, because I'd read the book, actually read it in high school, and I reread it Audible after I saw the movie. The movie's pretty good. It's not great, but it's pretty good. I mean, Ian McKellen is great. But I forgot how the book ends. The book ends very dark.
I don't remember how the movie ended, so.
Yeah, I think, I mean, of course, you know, the kid unleashes the monster, and there's the tense scene at the end. But I'm pretty sure at the end of the movie, you know, the kid comes out. It's like, oh, I didn't know what I did, and now, you know, I had to pay for it. But, you know, whew, I'm glad that didn't work out as badly as it could have. But if I remember correctly, at the end of the novel, they have the little confrontation because the Nazi has to kill the kid. And that's not going to happen, so the kid ends up killing the Nazi. Then the kid immediately grabs a rifle and goes over to the highway and starts shooting people, and that's how the book ends. Yeah, so. I don't know whether Stephen King was drinking a lot during this period and getting out of his aggression that way, or how that works. Anyway, I found this movie, even though it's kind of dark, I found it pretty great just because it's so pretty and it's so well-paced with the tension.
Well, good. I'm glad you liked it. I wanted us to watch it because I did really like it, and I think nobody saw it.
Well, I think everybody should. Well, not everybody.
It makes me lament that Clooney decided to not be a conventional action star, because I think I remember going all the way back to The Peacemaker, which I thought was a really fun movie.
What about, like, what is it, Out of Sight?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't really call that an action movie, but yeah, I love Out of Sight.
Yeah, I remember really liking it in the theater, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Definitely the best thing Jennifer Lopez has ever done.
Oh, absolutely.
But yeah, I mean, he's got the movie star chops, so he could have been the next action star. But, you know, since he didn't, and he can give us movies like this, I'm still pretty happy about it.
Well, he's also George Clooney. I mean, I know, because I haven't seen Mad Men, I know that you have an affection for John Hamm as an example of manliness.
Have you seen Bridesmaids?
Yeah.
He's the most amazing part of that movie.
Well, I suppose. George Clooney is like the ultimate guy as far as I'm concerned.
He seems to have figured out life.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, he's obviously he's attractive, but he's not like pretty attractive, and he's not, you know, he's not like buff, but he's fit. But he knows how to wear clothing, which, you know, since I have a body shape, at least right now, that does not accommodate the wearing of clothing with ease that, say, a George Clooney might. Like, he just seems put together.
Yes, he knows how to smile with his eyes while smirking with his mouth.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. I guess talking about male role models will have to wait for another podcast, because I don't really usually think in those terms. But talking to a couple of guys that I work with over the last couple of years, it's very interesting how some people really, it really matters to them. Like, the whole being a man thing is very, very important to them in a way that
I mean.
Like, they have, like, you have a role as a man that is different than women, than a woman's role in their mind, in the way they were raised, the way they were taught, the way they currently live. I'm also surprised by some of the women that I work with who are like type A personalities all the way. And yet they're like, oh yeah, it's going to be this way unless my husband doesn't like it. And then it'll be that way, which I find fascinating, like as an anthropological or like sociological thing.
That is fascinating.
Yeah. Anyway, but that's a much deeper.
That is not my marital experience.
Yeah. Well, nor mine. Absolutely not. Yeah. So, nor would I want it to be, actually, as it turns out.
No. No. Yeah. Absolutely not.
Yeah. So, anyway, anything else for tonight?
No. I'm off next week. So.
Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com. Or call us on our new voicemail account, to leave voice messages, or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts. Dial it already.